They left the empty town behind them, walked some more across the Great Stone Plain, and finally, they came to the Madness Maze. It had been excavated long ago, dug out of the deep bedrock of the Old World, and now the maze lay at the bottom of a great crater, hidden from view by an immense scaffolding supporting tons of bulky equipment built around a solid steel bunker enclosing the maze itself. A single curving pathway led down into the crater, carved into the inner stone wall. The crater seemed to grow larger and larger as Lewis and his party approached, like some awful wound in the surface of the world. The scaffolding looked like a cage built to contain some impossibly massive beast. The scientific base had taken decades to put together, and like everything else on Hayden, it had to be constantly maintained, repaired, and rebuilt as the dusty winds battered endlessly against it. Lewis and his people finally came to the top of the stairway, and there waiting for them was a single blue steel robot of Shub. It bowed its gleaming, featureless head to them.
"Welcome, Sir Deathstalker. We have waited so long for you to come here."
"Don't the rest of us get a bow?"
The robot produced one more bow for all of them.
"Welcome, Jessamine Flowers, Brett Random, Rose Constantine, Saturday. You are all known to us."
"Well, that's a comfort."
"Now, follow me, and I will take you to the maze."
Brett studied the stairway, and then peered dubiously over the edge of the crater.
"That is a long way down. Isn't there an elevator or something?"
"Not anymore. They couldn't be trusted. The dust gets everywhere. And besides, you'll feel the proximity of the maze long before you get anywhere near it. The maze affects everything here, the heart and the mind and the soul, as though it's the only real thing here. And we are all just shadows. The long descent on the stairs will allow you all time to acclimatize yourselves to the maze's influence. We have tried teleporting people straight to the maze. Most of them reacted badly. So now we recommend the stairs. This is Hayden, so we have to do things Hayden's way."
"What did the Empire scientists call this place?"
"They called it the Pit."
The robot set off down the stone stairway, and after a moment, the others followed. Lewis took the lead, with Saturday covering the rear. The steps were a good 5 feet wide, but there was no railing. Lewis kept his shoulder pressed to the inner wall to keep from straying too close to the edge and insisted the others keep to single file. It looked to be a really long way down.
"Are we the first visitors you've had?"
The robot's head turned through 180 degrees so that it could look directly at Lewis while its body continued sure-footedly down the steps.
"Finn Durandal came here. We teleported him straight to the maze. Surprisingly, its proximity didn't seem to affect him at all. Though it is hard to tell, with a delusional sociopath, he left us here to do his work. But we decided not to. Finn thought he'd gain more control over the Hayden operation by giving us access. But now Shub controls all access to the maze. Our research has replaced human research. We sent all the humans away. Being here was bad for them."
"Did you kill them all?"
"No. We put them on their ships and sent them home. We do not kill. All that lives is holy."
"What about those who didn't want to go?"
"We drugged their food to avoid unpleasant scenes. The last of the human scientists left yesterday. We knew you'd be here today."
"How can you be sure the Madness Maze isn't affecting you?"
"Because we're not really here. Our minds are safe in the artificial world we built to house them. Only our robots are here to be our eyes and hands. They are always breaking down and having to be replaced, like everything else here, no matter how well we build them. But what affects them does not reach us. But still, we don't like it here. It's scary."
There was a long pause as they all considered the implications of that.
"How could you be so sure we'd be here today?"
"An old friend arrived unexpectedly and told us. And his word has always been good."
"A friend of yours or ours?"
"Of us all. He's waiting for you at the entrance to the Madness Maze. He will answer all your questions."
"I didn't know we had any friends left."
"Are you still allied with Finn Durandal? You said you brought him here."
"Shub stands alone now. The Durandal may believe otherwise, but he will discover the truth in time."
What happened to your being humanity's children?
We grew up. And adults have responsibilities to themselves and to their parents.
Lewis decided not to follow up on that until he'd done a lot more thinking about the implications. He decided to stick with a more immediate problem.
What can you tell us about the Madness Maze? With the human scientists gone, you have uncontested access to the maze. The freedom to run any damn test you like. So, has access brought you any of the answers you've hoped for?
No. We are no wiser now than when we started. The maze resists all our probes, and remains unaffected by any test we can devise. What information we have collected makes no sense. The maze is too different to be easily understood. Perhaps too alien. Its structure, function, and intent cannot be determined either by examination or logical deduction. We cannot comprehend what it is supposed to do, or how, or why. Perhaps it is necessary to go through the maze, to experience its changes in order to be able to understand it.
Have you tried that yet?
No. It would be difficult to arrange. And besides, we are afraid.
And why are you still here? And why do you want us here?
To bring back Owen Deathstalker. Only another Deathstalker can do this. We need Owen to save us all again. From Finn Jurandal and from the Terror. First from Finn and his people, because soon he will realize he has no control over us, and then he will turn on us. Finn will allow no power to exist that he cannot control. He will send the armies of humanity against us once he realizes that we are not what he thinks we are. For we are prepared to die at our own hand, rather than become what he wants us to be, Shub as we once were, the enemies of humanity.
Then why don't you just go to Logris and kick Finn out? Hell, you're probably the only ones left who could take him on.
We could only remove him from power through violence, through death and destruction, by waging war and killing people. We have sworn a great and binding oath to ourselves never to use violence again. We will not kill, even to save ourselves. The Deathstalker did not require this oath of us, nor did Diana Virtue of blessed memory. We required it of ourselves, because of the debt we owe for the terrible things we did, that can never be repaid. So we work against Finn from behind the scenes, through other agents. We must put off for as long as possible the moment when Finn realizes that we are no longer allies. Because we cannot, will not, defend ourselves with violence, even if Finn attacks us. So far, he doesn't suspect the truth. Such concepts are alien to him. We will never kill again. All that lives is holy. We have risked much in sending the human scientists away. Do not disappoint us, Sir Deathstalker.
What do you want me to do?
Enter the maze, and become what you have to be to bring back Owen. We will protect you all while you are here on Hayden. No one will be allowed to land or interfere with you in any way.
How are you going to manage that if you won't fight?
Brett was getting out of breath from the long descent, but he was damned if he'd be left out of the argument.
I mean, once Finn learns you've chucked out his pet scientist, you can bet your metal arse he'll turn up here in force to give you the right good spanking.
Now there's a mental image I could have done without.
You will be safe. We give you our word. There are many amusing and annoying things that can be achieved through subtle use of teleportation.
You always said that extensive use of teleportation was impractical because it used up so much power. That's the reason you've always given for not making it available to humanity.
Teleportation uses up energy at an appalling rate. Repeated use will drain our homeworld reserves to a dangerously low level. And below a certain level, we could not survive. But we will protect you, whatever the cost. Just don't take too long, Deathstalker.
By the time they reached the end of the stone steps, at the very bottom of the pit, all of them except the robot were severely out of breath, bone-deep tired, and decidedly fractious. They stopped for a while, the robot waiting patiently, and leaned on each other or against the inner crater wall to get their breath back and flex their aching leg muscles. Even Saturday was out of sorts. She wasn't exactly built for steps. After a decent interval, the robot led the way through the great maze of scaffolding and equipment down a narrow steel corridor that wandered back and forth through the incomprehensible jumble of assorted tech, leading them on to the dark heart of the base and the Madness Maze itself. The corridor seemed to twist and turn, and even go back on itself, as though it had grown to resemble the maze it led to. Lewis and his people stood close behind the robot. They didn't want to get lost. They didn't meet anyone on their way. All the human scientists were gone, and all the other robots apparently had business elsewhere. There was tech everywhere, but it only muttered quietly to itself. Jessamine tried to beat some of the accumulated dust from her clothes, but gave it up as a bad job. She would have killed for a shower. She stuck very close to Lewis. She didn't like the fierce look of concentration on his face as he finally neared the end of his long journey and the destiny of his clan. He seemed to have forgotten all about her and the others. He was a Death Stalker, and the Madness Maze called to him. But they still had a stop to make first. The group rounded a sharp corner in the steel corridor and found themselves facing the annex to the maze. 12 cells closed off by shimmering force shields containing creatures that had once been men and women.
What have you done to them?
The maze did this, and then it grew this annex to house them. It maintains the force shields. We care for them as best we can. Interestingly enough, some of them knew you were coming before we did.
A man who had torn out his own eyes stumbled up to the force shield and looked right at Lewis with his blood-caked eye sockets. He was trying to smile.
Thank God you're here. Thank God. A Death Stalker has come at last.
The maze did this? No wonder we were never told. The maze really made a mess out of these poor bastards. They're worse than anything we dumped on Chandrakor. Jesus, the last time I saw anything like this, I'd been drinking absinthe for a fortnight.
Brett turned and glared at Lewis.
And you still want to go into the maze? I don't see any superhumans here, Deathstalker. Just a bunch of deluded fools who all drew the really short straw.
200 years of suffering, and they're still alive.
Jessamine looked accusingly at the robot.
Why have they been allowed to live like this? Why hasn't someone done the sane, compassionate thing and put them out of their misery?
They can't die. The maze made them, and the maze maintains them. And we don't have anything that can harm them.
Lewis, you can't go into the maze now. Not after you've seen what it does to the people who survive it.
They were not Deathstalkers. We have reason to believe things would be different for a Deathstalker. Ever since we took over here, we have been teleporting robots into these cells, attempting to communicate with the 12 survivors. Most of the robots were destroyed in one fashion or another, but we have no shortage of robot bodies. We have learned some interesting things.
Such as?
Lewis was watching a woman fade in and out of reality, silently pleading for help.
Communication has been difficult. I don't think we're capable of formulating the right questions. Perhaps you'll have better luck after you've been through the maze.
Jessamine was watching Lewis. Of them all, she was perhaps the least affected by the state of the 12 survivors. Work in show business long enough, and you're bound to see all kinds of freak shows. The sex circus on Aldebaran 10 had been particularly informative about the extremes to which the human form can be adapted. Jessamine was more interested in the way all of the survivors were reacting to Lewis, even the ones who shouldn't even have been aware of his presence, let alone his identity. They all oriented on Lewis, turning slowly to follow him as he strode slowly down the aisle facing the cells, and then back again. His presence seemed to soothe them, as though they'd all been waiting for him. For this moment.
They believe the Deathstalker will free them. Though we wouldn't advise it. They're far too dangerous ever to be let loose. Perhaps Lewis will be the one to kill them and put an end to their long suffering.
Wonderful. As if I wasn't under enough pressure. Take me to the maze. There's nothing I can do here.
The robot bowed to him and led the way to the entrance to the Madness Maze. Jessamine clung to Lewis's arm, trying desperately to persuade him against doing anything foolish, but he didn't seem aware of her. Rose looked interestedly at the 12 survivors as she passed, but had nothing to say. Brett made sure to keep Rose between him and the cells, just in case. Saturday stumped along at the rear, fed up with having to bend over in the human-scaled corridors. At the entrance to the Madness Maze, as promised, an old friend was waiting to greet them. Captain John Silence, the last living legend of the Age of Heroes, was leaning casually against the shimmering metal wall of the maze. He smiled and nodded to Lewis. He was wearing his old captain's uniform, of a kind that hadn't been worn for 200 years. He looked calm, relaxed, and very dangerous.
How the hell did you get here? There weren't any other ships on the pads. Shob teleport you in?
No. I can be whoever I have to be. A legacy of my time in the maze. Even though I was never allowed all the way in, to the heart and center of the mysteries, Owen was the only one ever to get that far. I always said he was the best of us.
You were the one who told Shub we'd be here today. How did you know?
It was inevitable. The chains of destiny wind very tightly around you, Lewis. You had to be here now, just as I do. The maze has a way of arranging things. Sometimes I think it's alive. Everything will seem a lot clearer once you've been through it.
I could still turn away. This is my life. I have duties and responsibilities. I don't know that I have the right to risk my life or my sanity in the maze when so many other people still depend on me.
You can't help them as you are. The game's got too big for merely human players.
You can't make me go in there.
In the maze, you'll find what you need to bring back Owen.
You always did know how to fight dirty, Captain. I don't have any choice, do I? I never did.
Lewis!
Hush, Jess. Captain, look after my people. Let no harm come to them in my absence.
I give you my word, Sir Deathstalker, upon my blood and my honor. I envy you, Lewis. At the center of the Madness Maze lie all the answers to all the questions you ever had. Or so I'm told. Only Owen knew what the heart held, and he disappeared before he could tell the rest of us.
Look, I'm getting really tired of enigmatic comments. I want some hard facts. Starting with, are you dead or not?
Not. I knew the attack on my house was coming, so I left quietly beforehand by secret ways, well before the mob arrived. I had already made preparations to become someone else. I'd been looking for a chance to put an end to my old life and move on. I had been feeling increasingly uncomfortable as a living legend, especially when I discovered people had started worshipping my statues. I never approved of the whole legend business anyway. I didn't recognize any of us in the pretty stories Robert and Constance made out of our lives. But they were my king and my queen, and so I said nothing. It seemed best. But now I had a chance to be free again. I could disappear and start a new life as someone else, without the burden of my past overshadowing everything I said and did. Robert and Constance didn't try that hard to confirm whether I really had died in the burnt-out ruins of my house. Alive, I was always a potential threat to all the myths they'd built their golden age on. Owen would have understood. He believed in history. Because the truth is always a better foundation than even the prettiest of lies.
Jesus, he's even more long-winded than Lewis. Can we please get to the point?
Well, really, we'd like to get out of this appalling place as soon as possible. Finn must know we're here by now.
You must excuse, Brett. It's either that or hit him a lot. And it does wear you out after a while.
Silence gave Brett a long, thoughtful look, and Brett felt an urgent need to hide behind someone. Silence smiled suddenly.
You're one of Random's bastards, aren't you? Claim descent from Jack and Ruby Journey. They were brave souls, but I never trusted either of them. Must run in the family.
Brett was still wondering how to take that when Silence turned back to Lewis.
After my reported death, I needed a new course. The maze kept me young and powerful, so I decided to work from the shadows as humanity's secret protector.
Didn't do too good a job of it, did you?
Brett!
Oh, stuff all that respect shit!
Brett surprised everyone, including himself. He stepped forward to glare right into Silence's face.
You're the last living legend, on a par with Owen and the others. So why didn't you stop, Finn?
Because I decided a long time ago that humanity should make its own way. I wanted to be its guardian, not its god. And I could have been your god if I'd wanted. But I have to say, I didn't see Finn coming. He's really just a focus for a whole bunch of pre-existing trends. If it hadn't been him, it would have been someone else. It was his time. Humanity has gone mad, not just Finn Durandal. He isn't doing anything they don't want him to do. How else do you think it all fell apart so quickly? And I never was as powerful as the others, despite what the legends say. You need Owen to stop the Durandal and the Terror. And I need Owen too. I need his certainty and his moral vision to tell me what to do for the best. Perhaps I just want him back so he can solve everything and look after humanity, so I won't have to anymore. A selfish thought, perhaps, but...
What's it like? What's it like inside the Madness Maze?
It's different for everyone. I don't know whether the maze is just a machine, or whether it's alive, or whether it's so advanced that such terms don't apply anymore. Walking through it changes you on every level you have. It adds on some new ones. It's like a wake-up call from God, as though the best part of you had been sleeping all your life, and the maze awakened it.
Why does the maze make some people crazy? Why does it kill people?
I don't know. I saw good people destroyed by the maze right in front of me, and I never knew why. But I do believe this, that a Deathstalker can make it safely through the maze, all the way to its hidden heart. The rest of you are, of course, free to try, but I can't guarantee your safety or your lives.
You couldn't drag me into that abomination. That thing feels wrong. Unnatural. It should be destroyed. Besides, Reptiloids are perfect already. Everybody knows that.
Saturday turned her back on the maze and stalked as far away from it as she could get in the confined space. Her back radiated disapproval, and her tail lashed angrily back and forth. The others studied the entrance to the maze silently. Jessamine faced it square on, her arms folded tightly. On the one hand, the maze scared the crap out of her, but on the other hand, she felt rather resentful that her safety couldn't be guaranteed just because she wasn't a bloody Deathstalker. That aristocratic bullshit had been thrown out centuries ago. She was every bit as good as Lewis, if not better. She was a star, dammit, a diva. She'd been worshipped and adored. Brett scowled at the maze. Looked at in just the right way, the maze was really nothing more than just another security system to protect a hidden treasure. And Brett had never seen a security system he couldn't get past eventually. Not that he had any intention of going in, of course. He had more sense. Even though it would be the ultimate test of his talents, and the greatest prize he'd ever got his greedy little hands on, he glanced across at Rose and was immediately worried by the look on her face. She was smiling. Brett had seen that look, that smile, before, in those rare moments when Rose found herself face to face with an enemy she thought might actually give her a real fight. Rose saw the maze as a challenge. And before any of them could stop her, Rose Constantine darted forward and plunged into the Madness Maze. She disappeared between its metal folds.
Rose!
And before he could stop himself, Brett ran in after her, because he just knew it was all going to go horribly wrong. The maze swallowed them both up without a murmur. Deathstalker Return, Predators and Victims is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2004, Simon R. Green. Production copyright 2007, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved.
performed by Richard Rowan, Michael Glenn, David Coyne, Vanessa Benjamin, Sonny Lasky, Corey James, Terrence Aselford, Ken Jackson, Nanette Savard, Dylan Lynch, Colleen Delaney, M.B. Van Dorn, Karen Carbone, Chris Rowan, Barbara Pinellini, Elliot Dash, Ariane Parker, Thomas Penny, Jeff Baker, Tim Carlin, James Lewis, and Mort Shelby. Directed and adapted for graphic audio by Rick Rowan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Wayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Chris Rowan. The Deathstalker Return theme was composed by Dan Smith. Additional original music by Chris Rowan and Dan Smith. If you enjoyed Deathstalker Return, be sure to look for the graphic audio version of DC Comics' Infinite Crisis, available at Road Stops Everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220, or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for the next episode of Mark Dalton, Owner-Operator. Graphic Audio presents Mark Dalton, Owner-Operator by Ido Van Belkom. Copyright 2007, Ido Van Belkom. Performed by David Coyne and the Graphic Audio Players. Episode 8, Drivers of the Purple Rage.
When Bud gave Mark Dalton his choice of Lowe's, he decided on the one headed for the East Coast. Even though it was one of the biggest ports on the east coast of North America, Halifax was one of the few parts of the country he'd never been to. Given the choice between a reefer of beef headed for Montreal, a flatbed laden with machine equipment bound for Sudbury that would have to be buttoned down every 100 kilometers, and a van trailer full of plastic pool toys made in China and destined for Halifax, the decision was an easy one to make. The lighter cargo would be easier on motherload, and since it wasn't due into the warehouse in Halifax for 3 days, he could take his time with it. Hopefully, the trip would be an uneventful one, which would be a welcome change after the events of the past few months. On his last trip to the West Coast and back, he'd helped a fellow trucker get untangled from a bunch of smugglers, got caught up in an insurance scam, got ripped off on some routine truck repairs, almost got killed working on a movie set, helped a friend keep his rig, and spent 2 hellish days as a dispatcher. That would have been enough excitement to last a lifetime for most truckers, but Mark seemed to have a talent for finding trouble. Or perhaps trouble had a way of finding its way to him, sort of like an old dog always being able to find its master. Whatever the reason for it, Mark was looking forward to a leisurely drive to the coast, maybe a day on the beach in Lawrencetown trying out a surfboard, and then a load out of the port heading west. The future looked comfortable. Peaceful. Just then, an older model Chrysler New Yorker cut in front of him, trying to squeeze into the lane to get around a Suburban pulling a trailer in the left-hand lane. Mark had to jam on the brakes to avoid hitting the Chrysler, and the light load gave the trailer's tires no real grip on the asphalt. The rear wheels locked up and his rig hardly slowed at all.
Shit.
Mark turned the wheel right to keep his front bumper from being clipped by the speeding car. The right front tire of his Peterbilt caught the shoulder and he started sliding to the right over the gravel and dirt on the side of the highway. The Chrysler straightened out, sped past the Suburban, and turned back into the passing lane, causing the driver of that vehicle to slam on his brakes and veer into the lane in front of Mark. Again, Mark had to turn the wheel sharply to avoid a collision. Behind him, the trailer swung wildly out across the highway and then mercifully straightened out.
Crazy son of a bitch!
By now, Mark was traveling slowly, and all the other vehicles around him were traveling less than 70. He downshifted a few times to find the right gear, then began the long, slow climb back up the gears to get his rig back up to speed. The Chrysler was about 0.5 kilometer up the highway, driving slightly slower now since it didn't have to weave and swerve through traffic. As Mark passed the Suburban, he could see the driver wiping his brow with a handkerchief, and the woman in the passenger seat jawing a blue streak as she pointed an accusatory finger at the Chrysler down the road. Mark was angry at the driver, too. After all, he could have killed somebody.
Well, you're not going to get away with that, Sonny.
He was up past 110 now, and he could probably get it up to 120 and cruise along at that speed for hours. Even if he didn't catch up to the Chrysler, he might be able to stay behind it, looming large in his mirrors so the driver would know that what he'd done was not only wrong, but downright dangerous. As the speedometer flirted with 120, The blue and white welcome sign for Kingston zoomed past on Mark's right. At this rate, he'd be through Brockville and Cornwall in just a few hours, and would likely reach Halifax much earlier than expected. More importantly, he was getting closer to the bastard in the Chrysler. Another few kilometers and he'd be on him, right up his rear end, giving him a little taste of his own medicine. Outside of Brockville, Mark had managed to pull directly behind the Chrysler. When he got up close to the 10-year-old burgundy sedan, he was able to read the vanity plate below the trunk lid. Big SHT. Mark wondered what was supposed to go between the H and the T. It was either an O or an I. The driver probably thought O, but Mark was convinced it was I. When the front of his Peterbilt was just a few feet from the rear bumper of the Chrysler, Mark let the driver have a blast from his horn. The sound must have startled the driver because the Buick suddenly swerved like a snake slithering down the road.
How do you like that?
The driver of the Chrysler rolled down his window and gave Mark the bird. Mark saw the man's middle finger waving in the air and tightened his grip on the steering wheel until his knuckles turned white. He could feel his face getting hot and red, and his body was a tightly packed ball of rage and in danger of exploding. The driver pulled over as if to let Mark by, but Mark wasn't having any of it. He pulled into the right-hand lane behind the car and kept his foot down hard on the accelerator. The driver was obviously tired of the high-speed chase and moved left to let Mark by.
You're not getting off that easy, asswipe.
Again, Mark pulled behind him, pushing the guy along with his huge rig, forcing him to keep up the pace, even if he had enough of playing cat and mouse. The driver moved into the right-hand lane again, but this time he tried slowing down so that he could get behind Mark and hopefully be done with it. But Mark wouldn't let him. He began inching over to the right, cutting off the lane and leaving the other driver with no place to go. The driver was forced onto the shoulder, just like Mark had been forced to do an hour earlier. Dirt, gravel, and dust rose up in a plume behind the car, and the driver had to struggle to keep the swerving car under control.
Yeah, how's that for you, buddy?
And then the car jammed on its brakes and began skidding to a stop. It was gone from the lane and had fallen far behind Mark's rig. Mark reveled in his victory. He'd shown that guy in the Chrysler a thing or two, and he doubted if he'd go speeding down the 401 again anytime soon. He raised the middle finger of his right hand, knowing full well the driver would never see it.
I'm number one, pal.
Just then, Mark saw a minivan in the lane ahead of him. He was still moving as quickly as his rig could go, and the minivan was cruising along, probably just under the speed limit. Mark took his foot off the accelerator and started downshifting, but it wasn't going to be enough. He jammed on the brakes and struggled to keep the front of his Peterbilt from slamming into the back of the tiny vehicle in front of him. The back tires cried out in pain and torment as they tried to get a grip on the highway, and the trailer began to slide out to the left, sweeping across the passing lane like an arm clearing off a tabletop. There was another car in the lane, a tiny Geo Metro that would probably be destroyed if it came into even the slightest contact with the trailer. And suddenly it was over. The trailer straightened out, the wheels unlocked, and he was rumbling along at 95. There were kids in the back of the minivan. They waved to him. Mark waved back. There was a young girl riding in the Metro. She was talking to the young guy behind the wheel, a boyfriend or fiancé, as if she didn't have a clue about how close she'd just been to being killed. Killed by a maniac road rager named Mark Dalton. How many times had he read about road rage and felt he was too much of a professional to ever become caught up in the heat of the moment? How many times had he shook his head after reading about some bizarre account of some experienced driver losing it out on the highway? How many times had he said he was above all that? Countless times. But in the end, he wasn't immune to it. He'd fallen victim to it, just like all the others, and nearly killed a few innocent people in the process.
Never again. It's not worth it.
He looked in his rearview mirror for the Chrysler, thinking maybe he could apologize to the driver. But the car was little more than a tiny speck in the mirrors now.
Keeping a safe distance, huh? And I don't blame you.
Mark focused on the road ahead, brought his rig up to 105 and switched on the cruise control, suddenly content to let the rest of the world pass him by. Between Brockville and Cornwall, the highway had been fairly quiet. Up ahead, in the lane in front of him, Mark saw an empty lowboy that he seemed to be reeling in at a pretty good clip. He hadn't had to pass anyone for a while, and he wasn't keen on doing it now since he was in no real hurry. But this rig was moving too slowly for him to follow for any length of time. Mark checked his mirrors, saw there wasn't anyone racing up the left lane, and pulled out to pass. He was creeping past the lowboy slowly, almost making him wonder why he was even bothering to pass the guy. But it soon became obvious that the guy had sped up while Mark was trying to pass him. Mark knew plenty of drivers who hated being passed by other truckers, especially when they were pulling a light load and some big tanker roared on because of some big horsepower advantage. Maybe this guy was like that, although it wasn't likely since Mark wasn't hauling anything but puffed up plastic and foam and the guy's trailer was empty. After about 20 seconds, Mark was still trying to get by, inching up the lowboy as if his fingers were walking along the trailer to mark his progress. He pressed the accelerator down hesitantly, not wanting to get caught up in another situation like the one he had earlier in the day. At last, he was even with the other trucker's cab. He looked over at the man and waved hello. The other driver had only been periodically glancing to his left, but when Mark gave him a wave, he immediately put his eyes on the road in front of him and kept them there.
And a good day to you too, buddy.
Finally, he was past the lowboy and was just waiting for his trailer to clear it so he could move back into the right-hand lane when he noticed a road crew working in the passing lane up ahead. One of their trucks was halfway out into the lane, and a few orange cones were lined up on the shoulder. Mark checked his mirror and saw the other driver was still trying to match his speed, as if he wanted Mark to work damn hard to pass him. Well, Mark was working. In fact, he was sweating now. He had two choices. He could either hit the road crew's truck, or he could cut off the lowboy and hope the two trucks didn't touch. He decided on the latter, since it was the only one in which it might be possible for everyone to get through it without a scratch. He floored the accelerator and waited for the last possible moment, then pulled right. He missed the rear end of the road crew's truck, which had now pulled completely onto the shoulder, and he managed to get far enough in front of the lowboy so that at worst, the other driver would have to slam on his brakes.
Sorry.
Mark looked into his mirrors. The lowboy was sending up a cloud of black smoke, and the trailer seemed to be shuddering on the asphalt. The rig began to grow smaller in his mirrors as the driver pulled over onto the side of the highway.
This is motherlode to the fella in the lowboy. Do you copy? Maybe we'll meet up somewhere down the road.
The lowboy had become a tiny speck in his mirrors now, but he could still make out the plume of smoke rising up from its stack as the rig got up some speed and prepared to rejoin traffic. But as the minutes passed, it became apparent that the lowboy wasn't just getting back into the highway's flow. He was making some serious steam trying to catch back up to Mark. With each kilometer that passed, the white early model Volvo with a rhubarb across the front of its grille grew larger and larger in his mirrors. He guessed it was around 10 years old, probably with more than a few million kilometers on it. It was obvious the rig wasn't going to win any races, but Mark wasn't in the mood for driving like a maniac. After all, he'd been there and done that just that morning, and that had been enough excitement, even for Mark. But the lowboy just kept on coming. Mark saw a sign for a rest station coming up in another 2 kilometers and figured it was about time for a break. Sitting down with a meal and a newspaper might do him some good, and it might also give the guy in the lowboy a chance to cool off. He pulled right onto the off-ramp and slowed his rig. He brought it around back and parked it so that he would be able to see it from several of the picnic tables set up outside the rest station. As he walked toward the main building, Mark noticed that the lowboy had also pulled in and had parked in one of the few open spots at the opposite end of the lot from Motherlode. He watched the rig for a long time, waiting for the man to get out and approach him, but he never did.
Well, at least he's not looking for a confrontation.
He used the restroom, ordered a burger, fries, and coffee, and then bought a copy of the National Post to read while he ate. He was halfway through the sports section by the time he finished eating and carried his coffee with him back to his rig. As far as he could tell, the lowboy driver hadn't come into the rest station, and maybe hadn't even left his rig. Perhaps he was tired and needed to catch a few winks. Hopefully, that would explain his erratic driving. Sure, the guy had spent most of the day driving to deliver whatever equipment he was carrying, and now that he was returning home, he was beat, just trying to put a few more kilometers under the wheels before taking a break. That was probably it. Had to be. It sure beat thinking that he'd tried to get Mark killed after Mark had cut him off through no fault of his own. Mark paused a moment in the parking lot. Maybe he should go over and knock on the guy's cab and explain what happened. He could tell him he was sorry and that he hadn't meant to send him off the road. Then again, the guy might be sleeping by now, dreaming of someone like Shannon Tweed, and Mark waking him wasn't going to make matters any better. Might even piss him off. But if Mark left now, the guy would be sleeping for another few hours, and by the time he woke up, Mark would be halfway to Halifax. That made the most sense. They were both professionals, after all. Best to just let it go. Water under the bridge, or more appropriately, asphalt under the tires. And they could both get on with the job of delivering goods and making themselves a living, while making sure stuff like that didn't happen again. Satisfied with his decision, Mark took a sip of his coffee and headed for his rig. In moments, he was underway. As he cleared his trailer of the other rigs parked in the lot, he noticed movement in his mirror. Apparently, Lowboy was on the move, too. By the time Mark neared the Ontario-Quebec border, it was obvious that the driver of the Lowboy was following him. He had matched Mark's pace every kilometer of the way, even passing other vehicles when it was unsafe to do so just to stay behind him. Mark wondered if he should radio for help, or perhaps try to reach the Ontario Provincial Police to report. Report what? That some driver was following him on the highway, driving just as fast as he was, no more or no less? There was no law against following another trucker. Hell, Mark did it himself often enough when he was tired and the guy in front of him was doing a decent enough pace. But this guy wasn't just following him, he was keeping Mark close to him, like he hadn't forgotten about being cut off by Mark back near Brockville.
Man, he must really be pissed off.
Mark upped his speed to 110, hoping to catch the other driver by surprise and see him fade into the distance. No chance. The guy was accelerating as well, keeping between one and two truck lengths behind him. It was a crazy situation, sort of like that famous TV movie Duel that starred Dennis Weaver as some sad sack salesman being pursued across the California desert by a crazed trucker driving a big tank trailer, presumably filled with oil. But that was a movie. This, on the other hand, was the real thing, and in real life, people could get hurt. Maybe Mark, maybe the other driver, but just maybe some two-year-old whose parents were driving to Montreal to visit Nana and Opa. Mark shook his head at the thought. He couldn't keep driving all day without a break. Neither of them could. But it didn't look as if the other driver was going to back down any, so it was up to Mark to do something. He decided the best thing would be to get away from the guy before he had the chance to do something crazy. Mark pressed his foot down hard on the accelerator. He heard the Cummins lag behind for a moment, then thrum at a higher pitch. Soon, the entire rig was gaining speed, and the speedometer slowly began to acknowledge he was accelerating. 115, 116, 118. Mark checked his mirrors and saw that the rhubarb on the front of the Volvo tractor wasn't getting any smaller, but actually loomed even larger in his mirrors, like the crazy fool was actually gaining on him. Mark kept accelerating, pulling out into the passing lane to glide by a pickup truck fully loaded with furniture and appliances. 120 now. The Lowboy was getting even closer, as if the guy was willing to burn out his motor just to give Mark a scare.
Well, I am scared. Scared that somebody's gonna get killed and the event will end up on one of those road rage websites for all my fellow truckers to see.
When he was down to just over 100, he brought his foot down again and began feeding fuel into the engine. Then he pulled over into the passing lane, giving the Lowboy behind him plenty of opportunity to get by. But the Lowboy slowed as well, staying in the right-hand lane as if he were minding his manners and had no business getting out in front of Mark. Cars were beginning to back up in both lanes behind them. Surely a cop would soon be onto them, and then Mark would be the one at fault. Mark pulled back into the right lane and brought Motherlode back up to a comfortable speed.
Damn it!
Even though the guy hadn't done a damn thing to him, his mere presence was incredibly annoying, and if nothing else, it was diverting Mark's attention away from the road. This had to be the opposite of road rage, Mark thought. Road unrage, he should call it, where a driver is driving erratically to avoid a nasty confrontation, but without any luck. He had a long way to go before he got to Halifax, and if this guy hounded him the entire way, he'd be a nervous wreck by the time it came for him to deliver his load and interact with a shipper.
All right, I've had enough.
He decided it was time he reported this guy to the police. Regardless of what his intentions were, the Lowboy driver had put people's lives at risk by trying to stay behind Mark at all costs. Even if the police didn't do anything, at least the guy would know Mark wasn't about to let him get away with trying to scare him half to death.
This is a 911, Ontario Provincial Police. Do you copy?
No answer. In fact, judging by the lack of static coming from the box, Mark couldn't even be sure his radio was working.
Can I have a radio check, please?
Son of a bitch!
He realized the guy had probably disabled his radio at the last rest station. This was getting serious, and Mark was getting nervous. He could pull over and stop, but that would just give the guy the chance to pick a fight with him in the middle of nowhere. Besides, it was recommended that you drive to a police station or a public place, or, if at night, some place where there was plenty of light. Well, it was the middle of the day and there wasn't a police station in sight. Up ahead, there was a sign for another rest station. Excellent. Mark would pull in, park his rig, and try to talk some sense to the guy. He'd apologize, buy the guy lunch, anything, just so that it could be over and they could both be on their way. And not only that, but a bathroom break after all the excitement on the road wouldn't be a bad idea either. A second sign appeared at the side of the highway, and Mark knew that one way or another, this whole thing would be over in just a few minutes. Mark slowed and signaled to exit the highway. He checked his mirrors and saw that the lowboy wasn't signaling at all. He wasn't even slowing down. Mark watched closely as the lowboy continued on past the rest station and on down the highway. He was gone.
Thank God that's over with.
Mark made use of the facilities inside the rest station, and then wondered if he should pick up a coffee and something to go. A coffee would be great, and there was a Tim Hortons in the rest station, which was his favorite. But there was something about coffee and long hauls that just didn't mix. If he had another coffee now, he'd be stopping at every rest stop between here and Halifax. No thanks. But even though he didn't want a coffee, he wasn't keen on heading back onto the highway just yet either. He wanted to give the lowboy as much time alone on the highway as he could. With any luck, someone else might cut him off or wave hello or just get on the guy's nerves. Admittedly, it wasn't much of a plan, but Mark wasn't sure there was a solution to this particular problem. Lowboy was obviously crazy. Either that or road raged. Mark decided on an apple fritter that would keep his stomach happy until dinner time, and he ate it in silence while he watched the traffic zoom by along the highway outside the window. The trucks passed by at random, and it was a lot like a lottery, really. Any one of those drivers could snap at any moment, and when it happened, years of experience, professionalism, and just plain common sense would all get tossed out the window. It was a lottery, all right, but one in which there was no winners and way too many losers. He finished his fritter and headed back out to his rig. Before he got underway, Mark checked his radio and antenna, hoping he might be able to repair them. No such luck. Not only had Lowboy cut several of his wires, he had cut entire sections out of the wires, leaving Mark with a bunch of naked ends that were too short to be reconnected. Mark could feel the anger gathering within him, a hot pot about to boil, and did his best to remain calm. Sure, he was pissed off, but it wasn't going to do him any good to charge out of the rest station looking for blood. He could get the radio fixed easily enough, and if he needed to, he could always dial 911 on his cell phone. Reluctantly, Mark climbed into Motherlode, started her up, and headed back onto the highway. About 5 kilometers out of the rest station, Mark saw a rig up ahead parked on the shoulder.
Oh, come on!
As he neared, it became obvious that the rig pulled over onto the side of the highway was none other than the lowboy being pulled by the Rhubarb Volvo.
Doesn't this guy ever give up?
He tried to take a quick look into the cab as he went by, but the light was wrong, and he couldn't make out anyone in either of the front seats. For a moment, he thought that maybe the guy was taking a nap, but he'd wrongly assumed that once already, and he knew in his heart that all the guy had been doing there was waiting for Mark to pass. And sure enough, before Mark was even 100 meters down the highway, the Volvo's twin stacks belched a cloud of smoke, and the lowboy was signaling a return to the highway. Mark wasn't sure how long he could go on like this. Up ahead on the right-hand side of the highway, a pair of yellow lights were flashing atop a large rectangular sign, beckoning drivers to pull over and drive through the weigh scales.
Yes.
Mark usually didn't have much affection for the inspectors who manned the coupes, but right now they seemed heaven sent. However, as much as Mark wanted to be stopped for an inspection, his cargo was very light, and he was well below his gross vehicle weight limit of 80,000 pounds. And even though Motherlode was a 6-year-old Peterbilt 379, he always kept her in top condition, so there would be no obvious reason for the inspectors to pull him over.
Just my luck.
He'd be through the station in seconds, and then he and Lowboy would be back on the highway just a kilometer down the road from where they left off. Mark had to think of something, and quick. And then he was struck with an idea. He reached over and got out his logbook, then took out a large black magic marker from the visor above him and quickly scribbled a message onto the back cover of the book. Then, as he slowed down to drive over the scales, he reached over and pressed the logbook up against the passenger window. Hopefully, he was moving slowly enough, and at least one of the inspectors was attentive enough to read the message. Mark watched closely as an inspector sipping a cup of coffee squinted in Mark's direction as he drove by. At first, the man expressed surprise. Then, he quickly put down his coffee and nodded at Mark. Mark slid back into the driver's seat and began shifting up through the gears, preparing for his return to highway traffic. At the same time, he kept an eye in his mirrors, watching all of the inspectors scramble out of the coupe and flag down Lowboy before he had a chance to drive through the scales. Lowboy came to a stop, probably wondering what the hell was going on. And then, before fixing his eyes on the road in front of him, Mark glanced over at the logbook that was now on the passenger seat and read the message he'd hurriedly scribbled onto the book's back cover. Low boy behind, wielding gun. His penmanship was a bit sloppy, and he'd almost made the letters too big to fit onto the back of the book, but judging by the result, the four words had done their job. Maybe he had a gun, maybe he didn't. Either way, by the time the inspectors had it all figured out, Mark would be hundreds of kilometers away and driving in peace.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.